for 100 years. You've probably heard it, in fact. Most folk have. She ended up calling it the Song of Seven Sorrows. Yes, Denna composed it, and I was the first person to hear it played entire. As the last notes faded in the air, Denna lowered her hands, unwilling to meet my eye. I sat, still and silent, on the grass. For this to make sense, you need to understand something every musician knows. Singing a new song is a nervous thing. More than that, it's terrifying. It's like undressing for the first time in front of a new lover. It's a delicate moment. I needed to say something. A compliment, a comment, a joke, a lie, anything was better than silence. But I couldn't have been more stunned if she had written a hymn praising the Duke of Gibeah. The shock was simply too much for me. I felt raw as reused parchment, as if every note of her song had been another flick of a knife, scraping until I was entirely blank and wordless. I looked down dumbly at my hands. They still held the half-formed circle of green grass I'd been weaving when the song began. It was a broad, flat plate already beginning to curve into the shape of a ring. Still looking down, I heard the rustle of Denna's skirts as she moved. I needed to say something. I'd already waited too long. There was too much silence in the air. "The city's name wasn't Myrinitel," I said, without looking up. It was not the worst thing I could have said, but it wasn't the right thing to say. There was a pause.
"What?"
"Not Myrinitel," I repeated. "The city Lanre burned was Myr Tirinio. Sorry to tell you that. Changing a name is hard work. It will wreck the meter in a third of your verses." I was surprised at how quiet my voice was, how flat and dead it sounded in my own ears. I heard her draw a surprised breath.
"You've heard the story before?"
I looked up at Denna, her expression excited. I nodded, still feeling oddly blank, empty, hollow as a dried gourd.
"What made you pick this for a song?" I asked her.
It wasn't the right thing to say, either. I can't help but feel that if I'd said the right thing at that moment, everything would have turned out differently. But even now, after years of thinking, I can't imagine what I could have said that might have made things right. Her excitement faded slightly. "I found a version of it in an old book when I was doing genealogical research for my patron," she said. "Hardly anyone remembers it, so it's perfect for a song. It's not like the world needs another story about Orin Velsitor. I'll never make my mark repeating what other musicians have already hashed over 100 times before." Denna gave me a curious look. "I thought I was going to be able to surprise you with something new. I never would have guessed you'd heard of Lanre."
"I heard it years ago," I said numbly, "from an old storyteller in Tarbian."
"If I had half your luck," Denna shook her head in dismay. "I had to piece it together out of 100 little scraps. She made a conciliatory gesture. "Me and my patron, I should say. He's helped."
"Your patron," I said.
I felt a spark of emotion when she mentioned him. Hollow as I was, it was surprising how quickly the bitterness spread through my gut, as if someone had kindled a fire inside me.
Denna nodded. "He fancies himself a bit of a historian," she said.
"I think he's angling for a court appointment. He wouldn't be the first to ingratiate himself by shining a light on someone's long-lost heroic ancestor. Or maybe he's trying to invent a heroic ancestor for himself. That would explain the research we've been doing in old genealogies." She hesitated for a moment, biting her lips. "The truth is," she said, as if confessing something, "I half suspect the song is for Alvaron himself. Master Ash has implied he's had dealings with the mayor." She gave a mischievous grin. "Who knows? Running in the circles you do, you might have already met my patron and not even known it." My mind flickered over the hundreds of nobles and courtiers I'd met in passing over the last month, but it was hard to focus on their faces.
The fire in my gut was spreading until my whole chest was full of it. But enough of this, Denna said, waving her hands impatiently. She pushed her harp away and folded her legs to sit cross-legged on the grass. You're teasing me. What did you think of it?
I looked down at my hands and idly fingered the flat braid of green grass I'd woven. It was smooth and cool between my fingers. I couldn't remember how I'd planned to join the ends together to form a ring.
I know it's got some rough patches, I heard Denna say, her voice brimming with nervous excitement. I'll have to fix that name you mentioned, if you're sure it's the right one. The beginning is rough, and the seventh verse is a shambles, I know. I need to expand the battles and his relationship with Lyra. The ending needs tightening, but overall, what did you think?
Once she smoothed it out, it would be brilliant. As good a song as my parents might have written. But that just made it worse. My hands were shaking, and I was amazed at how hard it was to make them stop. I looked away from them, up at Denna. Her nervous excitement faded when she saw my face.
You're going to have to rework more than just the name. I tried to keep my voice calm.
Lanray wasn't a hero.
She looked at me oddly, as if she couldn't tell if I was making a joke.
What?
You've got the whole thing wrong, I said. Lanray was a monster, a traitor. You need to change it.
Denna tossed back her head and laughed. When I didn't join her, she cocked her head, puzzled.
You're serious?
I nodded. Denna's face went stiff. Her eyes narrowed and her mouth made a thin line.
You have to be kidding.
Her mouth worked silently for a moment. Then she shook her head.
It wouldn't make any sense. The whole story falls apart if Lanray isn't the hero.
It's not about what makes a good story, I said. It's about what's true.
True? She looked at me incredulously. This is just some old folk story. None of the places are real. None of the people are real. You might as well get offended at me for coming up with a new verse for Tinker Tanner.
I could feel words rising in my throat, hot as a chimney fire. I swallowed down hard against them.
Some stories are just stories, I agreed, but not this one. It's not your fault. There's no way you could have...
Oh, well, thank you, she said bitingly. I'm so glad this isn't my fault.
Fine, I said sharply. It is your fault. You should have done more research.
What do you know about the research I did? She demanded. You haven't the slightest idea. I've been all over the world digging up pieces of this story.
It was the same thing my father had done. He'd started writing a song about Lanray, but his research led him to the Chandrian. He'd spent years chasing down half-forgotten stories and digging up rumors. He wanted his song to tell the truth about them, and they had killed my entire troop to put an end to it. I looked down at the grass and thought about the secret I had kept for so long. I thought of the smell of blood and burning hair. I thought of rust and blue fire and the broken bodies of my parents. How could I explain something so huge and horrible? Where would I even begin? I could feel the secret deep inside me, huge and heavy as a stone.
In the version of the story I heard, I said, touching the far edge of the secret, Lanray becomes one of the Chandrian. You should be careful. Some stories are dangerous.
Denna stared at me for a long moment.
The Chandrian? She said incredulously.
Then she laughed. It was not her usual delighted laugh. This was sharp and full of derision.
What kind of child are you?
I knew exactly how childish it made me sound. I felt myself flush hot with embarrassment, my whole body suddenly prickling with sweat. I opened my mouth to speak, and it felt like cracking open the door of a furnace.
I'm like a child? I spat. What do you know about anything, you stupid—
I almost bit off the end of my tongue to keep from shouting the word whore.
You think you know everything, don't you? She demanded. You've been to the university, so you think the rest of us are— Quit looking for excuses to be upset and listen to me! I snapped.
The words poured out of me like molten iron.
You're having a snit like a spoiled little girl.
Don't you dare. She jabbed a finger at me. Don't talk to me like I'm some sort of witless farm girl. I know things they don't teach at your precious university. Secret things. I'm not an idiot. You're acting like an idiot! I shouted so loudly the words hurt my throat. You won't shut up long enough to listen to me! I'm trying to help you! Denna sat in the center of a chilly silence. Her eyes were hard and flat. That's what it's all about, isn't it? She said coldly. Her fingers moved in her hair, every flick of her fingers stiff with irritation. She untied her braids, smoothed them out, then absent-mindedly retied them in a different pattern. You hate that I won't take your help. You can't stand that I won't let you fix every little thing in my life. Is that it? Well, maybe someone needs to fix your life, I snapped. You've made a fair mess of it so far, haven't you? She continued to sit very still, her eyes furious. What makes you think you know anything about my life? I know you're so afraid of anyone getting close that you can't stay in the same bed 4 days in a row, I said, hardly knowing what I was saying anymore. Angry words poured out of me like blood from a wound. I know you live your whole life burning bridges behind you. I know you solve your problems by running. What makes you think your advice is worth one thin sliver of a damn anyway? Denna burst out. Half a year ago, you had one foot in the gutter, hair all shaggy and only 3 raggedy shirts. There isn't a noble in 100 miles of Imre that would piss on you if you were on fire. You had to run 1,000 miles to have a chance of a patron. My face burned with shame at her mention of my 3 shirts, and I felt my temper flare hot again. You're right, of course, I said scathingly. You're much better off. I'm sure your patron would be perfectly happy to piss on you. Now we get to the heart of it, she said, throwing her hands up in the air. You don't like my patron because you could get me a better one. You don't like my song because it's different from the one you know. She reached for her harp case, her movements stiff and angry. You're just like all the rest. I'm trying to help you. You're trying to fix me, Denna said crisply as she put away her harp. You're trying to buy me, to arrange my life. You want to keep me like I'm your pet, like I'm your faithful dog. I'd never think of you as a dog, I said, giving her a bright and brittle smile. A dog knows how to listen. A dog has sense enough not to bite a hand that's trying to help. Our conversation spiraled downward from there. At this point in the story, I'm tempted to lie. To say I spoke these things in an uncontrollable rage, that I was overwhelmed with grief at the memory of my murdered family, I'm tempted to say I tasted plum and nutmeg. Then I would have some excuse, but they were my words. In the end, I was the one who said those things. Only me. Denna responded in kind, hurt and furious and sharp-tongued as myself. We were both proud and angry and filled with the unshakable certainty of youth. We said things we never would have said otherwise, and when we left, we did not leave together. My temper was hot and bitter as a bar of molten iron. It seared at me as I walked all the way back to Severin. It burned as I made my way through the city and waited for the freight lifts. It smoldered as I stalked through the mayor's estates and slammed the door to my rooms behind me. It was only hours later that I cooled enough to regret my words. I thought of what I might have said to Denna. I thought of telling her of how my troop was killed, about the Chandrian. I decided I would write her a letter. I would explain it all, no matter how foolish or unbelievable it seemed. I brought out pen and ink and laid a sheet of fine white paper on the writing desk. I dipped the pen and tried to think of where I could begin. My parents had been killed when I was 11. It was an event so huge and horrifying, it had driven me nearly mad. In the years since, I had never told a soul of those events. I had never so much as whispered them in an empty room. It was a secret I had clutched so tightly for so long that when I dared think of it, it lay so heavy in my chest that I could barely breathe. I dipped the pen again, but no words came. I opened a bottle of wine, thinking it might loosen the secret inside me. Give me some finger hold I could use to pry it up.
I drank until the room spun and the nib of the pen was crusted with dry ink. Hours later, the blank sheet still stared at me, and I beat my fists against the desk in fury and frustration, striking it so hard my hand bled. That is how heavy a secret can become. It can make blood flow easier than ink. Chapter 74. Rumors. The day after I fought with Denna, I woke late in the afternoon, feeling miserable for all the obvious reasons. I ate and bathed, but pride kept me from heading down to Severin Low to look for Denna. I sent a ring to Braden, but the runner returned with the news that he was still away from the estate. So, I opened a bottle of wine and began to leaf through the pile of stories that had been slowly accumulating in my room. The majority of these were scandalous, spiteful things, but their petty meanness suited my mood and helped distract me from my own misery. Thus, I learned the previous Comte Banbride hadn't died of consumption, but of syphilis contracted from an amorous stable hand. Lord Veston was addicted to Denner resin, and money intended for the maintenance of the King's Road was paying for his habit. Baron Jackus had paid several officials to avoid scandal when his youngest daughter was discovered in a brothel. There were two versions of that story, one where she was selling, and another where she was buying. I filed that information away for future use. I'd started a second bottle of wine by the time I read that young Natalia Lackless had run away with a troupe of traveling performers. Her parents had disowned her, of course, leaving Meloin the only heir to the Lackless lands. That explained Meloin's hatred of the Rue, and made me doubly glad I hadn't made my edema blood public here in Severin. There were three separate stories of how the Duke of Cormisant flew into rages while in his cups, beating whoever happened to be nearby, including his wife, his son, and several dinner guests. There was a brief speculative account of how the king and queen held depraved orgies in their private gardens, hidden from the eyes of the royal court. Even Braden made an appearance. He was said to conduct pagan rituals in the secluded woods outside his northern estates. They were described with such extravagant and meticulous detail that I wondered if they weren't copied directly from the pages of some old Aeturian romance. I read well into the evening and was only halfway through the stack of stories when I finished the bottle of wine. I was just about to send a runner for another when I heard the soft hush of air from the other room that announced Alvaron's entrance into my chambers through his secret passage. I pretended to look surprised when he entered the room. "Good afternoon, Your Grace," I said as I came to my feet. "Sit, if you wish," he said shortly. I remained standing out of deference, as I'd learned it was better to err on the side of formality with the mayor. "How are things progressing with your lady?" I asked. From Stapes's excited gossip, I knew matters were rapidly coming to a close. "We pledged a formal troth today," he said distractedly. "Signed papers and all. It's done." "If you'll forgive me for saying so, Your Grace, you don't seem very pleased." He gave a sour smile. "I suppose you've heard about the trouble on the roads of late?" "Only rumors, Your Grace." He snorted. "Rumors I have been trying to keep quiet. Someone has been waylaying my tax collectors on the North Road." That was serious. "Collectors, Your Grace?" I asked, stressing the plural. "How much have they managed to take?" The mayor gave me a stern look that let me know the impropriety of my question. "Enough. More than enough. This is the fourth I've had go missing. Over half of my northern taxes taken by highwaymen." He gave me a serious look. "The Lackless lands are in the north, you know." "You think the Lacklesses are waylaying your collectors?" He gave me a stunned look. "What? No, no. It's bandits in the Eld." I blushed a little in embarrassment. "Have you sent out patrols, Your Grace?" "Of course I've sent out patrols," he snapped. "I've sent a dozen. They haven't found so much as a campfire." He paused and looked at me. "I suspect someone in my guard is in league with them." His expression was grave. "I assume Your Grace has given your collectors escorts?" "Two apiece," he said. "Do you know how much it costs to replace a dozen guardsmen? Armor, weapons, horses?"
he sighed.
On top of it all, only part of the stolen taxes are mine. The rest belong to the king.
I nodded in understanding.
I don't imagine he's very pleased.
Alvaron waved a hand dismissively.
Oh, Roderick will have his money regardless. He holds me personally responsible for his tithe. So I'm forced to send the collectors around again to gather His Majesty's share a second time.
I don't imagine that sits very well with most people, I said.
It does not.
He sat in an overstuffed chair and rubbed his face tiredly.
I'm at my wit's end over the matter. How will it look to Maelowyn if I cannot keep my own roads safe?
I took a seat as well, facing him.
What of Dagon? I asked. Couldn't he find them?
Alvaron gave a short, humorless bark of a laugh.
Oh, Dagon would find them. He'd have their heads on poles inside 10 days.
Then why not send him? I asked, puzzled.
Because Dagon is a man of straight lines. He would raise a dozen villages and set fire to 1,000 acres of the Eld to find them.
He shook his head seriously.
Even if I thought him suited to this task, he is tracking down Codicus at the moment. Besides, I believe there may be magic at work in the Eld, and that is outside Dagon's ken.
I suspected the only magic at work was 6 sturdy Modegan longbows, but it's the nature of people to cry magic whenever they're faced with something they cannot easily explain, especially in Ventus. Alvaron leaned forward in his seat.
Might I rely on your help in this?
There was only one response to that.
Of course, Your Grace. Do you know much woodcraft?
I studied under a yeoman when I was younger. I exaggerated, guessing he was looking for someone to help devise a better defense for his collectors. I know enough to track a man and hide myself.
Alvaron raised an eyebrow at that.
Really?
You are possessed of quite the diverse education, aren't you?
I've led an interesting life, Your Grace.
The bottle of wine I'd drunk made me bolder than usual, and I added, I've got an idea or two you might find helpful in dealing with your bandit problem.
He leaned forward in his chair.
Do tell.
I could devise some arcane protection for your men. I made a flourish with the long fingers of my right hand, hoping it looked sufficiently mystical. I juggled numbers in my head and wondered how long it would take to create an arrow catch using only the equipment in Codicus's tower.
Alvaron nodded thoughtfully. That might suffice if I was only concerned for the safety of my collectors, but this is the King's Road, a major artery of trade. I need to be rid of the bandits themselves.
In that case, I said, I would assemble a small group who know how to make their way quietly in a forest. They shouldn't have too much difficulty locating your bandits. When they do, it should be a simple matter to send your guard out to catch them.
Easier yet to set an ambush and kill them, wouldn't you say?
Alvaron said slowly, as if looking to gauge my reaction.
Or that, I admitted. Your Grace is the arm of the law.
Death is the penalty for banditry, especially on the King's Road, Alvaron said firmly.
Does that seem harsh to you?
Not in the least, I said, looking him squarely in the eye.
Safe roads are the bones of civilization.
Alvaron surprised me with a sudden smile.
Your plan is the very image of my own. I have gathered a handful of mercenaries to do just as you've suggested. I've had to move secretly, as I don't know who might be sending these bandits their warnings. But I've got 4 good men ready to leave tomorrow. A tracker, 2 mercenaries with some skill in the forest, and an Adem mercenary. The last did not come cheaply, either.
I gave him a congratulatory nod.
You've already planned it better than I could, Your Grace. It hardly seems as if you need my help at all.
Quite the contrary, he said.
I still need someone with a little sense to lead them.
He looked at me meaningfully.
Someone who understands magic.
Someone I can trust. I felt a sudden sinking sensation.
Alvaron got to his feet, smiling warmly.
Twice now you have served me beyond all expectations. Are you familiar with the expression, third time pays for all? Again, there was only one reasonable answer to that question. Yes, Your Grace. Alvaron took me to his rooms, and we looked over maps of the countryside where his men had been lost. It was a long stretch of the King's Highway running through a piece of the Eld that had been old when Vintus was nothing more than a handful of squabbling sea kings. It was a little more than 80 miles away. We could be there in 4 days of hard walking. Stapes provided me with a new travel sack, and I packed it as well as I was able. I took a few of the more practical clothes from my wardrobe, though they were still more suited for a ballroom than the road. I packed away a few items I'd quietly pilfered from Cauticus's lab over the last span, and gave Stapes a list of a few essential items I was lacking, and he produced them all more quickly than a grocer in the store. Finally, at the hour when all but the most desperate and dishonest persons are abed, Alvaron gave me a purse containing 100 silver bits. "This is a messy way of handling it," Alvaron said. "Normally, I would give you a writ charging citizens to provide you with assistance and aid." He sighed. "But using something like that as you travel would be as good as blowing a trumpet announcing your arrival." I nodded. "If they're clever enough to have a spy among your guard, it's safe to assume they have connections with the local populace as well, Your Grace." "They might be the local populace," he said darkly. Stapes led me out of the estate through the same secret passage the mayor used to enter my rooms. Carrying a hooded thief's lamp, he took me through several twisting passages, then down a long, dark stairway that bored deep into the stone of the sheer. Thus, I found myself standing alone in the chill cellar of an abandoned shop in Severin Low. It was in the section of the city that had been ravaged by fire some years ago, and the building's few remaining roof beams stretched like dark bones against the first pale light of dawn. I stepped from the burned shell of the building. Above, the mayor's estates perched on the edge of the sheer like some predatory bird. I spat, none too pleased with my situation, press-ganged into mercenary service. My eyes were gritty from my sleepless night and my long journey through the twisting stone passages in the sheer. The wine I'd drunk wasn't improving anything either. For the last few hours, I could feel myself growing less drunk and more hungover by slow degrees. I'd never been awake through the entire process before, and it was not pleasant. I'd managed to keep up appearances in front of Alvaron and Stapes, but the fact of the matter was that my gut was sour and my thoughts were thick and sluggish. The cool pre-dawn air cleared my head a little, and within 100 steps, I began thinking of things I'd forgotten to include on the list I'd given Stapes. The wine had done me no favors there. I had no tinderbox, no salt, no knife. My lute. I hadn't picked it up from the luthier after having its loose peg fixed. Who knew how long I might be hunting bandits for the mayor? How long would it sit unclaimed before the man decided it had been abandoned? I went 2 miles out of my way, but found the luthier's shop dark and lifeless. I hammered on the door to no avail. Then, after a moment's indecision, I broke in and stole it. Though it hardly seemed to be stealing, since the loot was mine to begin with, and I'd already paid for the repairs. I had to climb a wall, force a window, and trip 2 locks. It was fairly simple stuff, but given my sleepless, wine-sodden head, I'm probably lucky I didn't fall off the roof and break my neck. But aside from a loose piece of slate that set my heart racing, things went smoothly, and I was back on my way in 20 minutes. The 4 mercenaries Alvaron had assembled were waiting in a tavern 2 miles north of Severin. We made brief introductions and left immediately, heading north on the King's Highway. My thoughts were so sluggish that I was miles north of Severin before I began to reconsider a few things. Only then did it occur to me that the mayor might have been less than completely honest in everything he had told me the night before. Was I truly the best person to lead a handful of trackers into an unfamiliar forest to kill a band of highwaymen? Did the mayor really think so much of me? No. Of course not. It was flattering, but simply not true. The mayor had access to better resources than that. The truth was,
He probably wanted his sweet-tongued assistant out of the way now that he had the Lady Lackless well in hand. I was foolish for not realizing it sooner. So he sent me on a fool's errand to get me out from underfoot. He expected me to spend a month chasing his wild goose in the deep forest of the Eld, then come back empty-handed. The purse made better sense, too. 100 bits would keep us provisioned for a month or so. Then, when I ran out of money, I'd be forced to return to Severin, where the mayor would cluck his tongue in disappointment and use my failure as an excuse to ignore some of the favor I'd accumulated so far. On the other hand, if I got lucky and found the bandits, all the better. It was exactly the sort of plan I'd credit to the mayor. No matter what happened, he got something he wanted. It was irritating, but I could hardly go back to Severin and confront him. Now that I'd committed myself, there was nothing to do but make the best of the situation. As I walked north, my head throbbing and my mouth gritty, I decided I would surprise the mayor again. I'd hunt down his bandits. Then third time would pay for all, and Mayor Alvaron would be well and truly in my debt. Chapter 75. The Players. Over the next few hours of walking, I did my best to get to know the man Alvaron had saddled me with. I speak figuratively, of course, as one of them was a woman, and we were all 5 of us afoot. Tempe caught my eye first and held it the longest, as he was the first Adem mercenary I'd ever met. Far from being the imposing, hard-eyed killer I'd expected, Tempe was rather nondescript, neither particularly tall nor heavily built. He was fair-skinned with light hair and pale gray eyes. His expression was blank as fresh paper. Strangely blank. Studiously blank. I knew Adem mercenaries wore blood-red clothing as a sort of badge, but Tempe's outfit was different than I'd expected. His shirt was held tight against his body with a dozen soft leather straps. His pants, too, were belted tightly at the thigh and calf and knee. Everything was dyed the same bright and bloody red, and it fit him snugly as a gentleman's glove. As the day grew warm, I saw him begin to sweat. After living in the cool, thin air of the Stormwall, the weather must have seemed disproportionately hot to him. An hour before noon, he loosened the leather straps of his shirt and peeled it away, using it to wipe the sweat from his face and arms. He didn't seem even slightly self-conscious about walking the King's Highway naked to the waist. Tempe's skin was so pale it was almost the color of cream, and his body was lean and sleek as a coursing hound, his muscles shifting under his skin with an animal grace. I tried not to stare, but my eyes couldn't help but pick out the thin, pale scars that crossed his arms and chest and back. He never offered a word of complaint about the heat. Words of any sort seemed rare from him, and he responded to most questions with a nod or a shake of the head. He carried a travel sack like mine, and his sword, far from being intimidating, seemed rather short and unimpressive. Daedan was as different from Tempe as one man can be from another. He was tall, wide, and thick around the chest and neck. He carried a heavy sword, a long knife, and wore a mismatched set of boiled leather armor, hard enough to knock on and often mended. If you have ever seen a caravan guard, then you have seen Daedan, or at least someone cut from the same bolt of cloth. He ate most, complained most, swore most, and had a stubborn streak thicker than a broad oak plank. But to be fair, he also had a friendly manner and an easy laugh. I was tempted to think of him as stupid due to his manners and his size, but Daedan had a quick wit when he bothered using it. Hespo was a female mercenary, not as rare a creature as some folk think. In appearance and equipage, she was a near mirror of Daedan. The leather, the heavy sword, the slightly weather-worn and worldwise attitude. She had broad shoulders, strong hands, and a proud face with a jaw like a cinder brick. Her hair was blonde and fine, but cut short in the fashion of a man's. But to see her as a female version of Daedan was a mistake. She was reserved where Daedan was all bravado. And while Daedan had an easy manner when his temper wasn't up, Hespa had a vague hardness about her, as if she were constantly expecting someone to give her trouble. Martin was the oldest of us, our tracker.
He wore a little leather, softer and better cared for than Daydan's or Hespa's. He carried a long knife, a short knife, and a hunter's bow. Martin had worked as a huntsman before falling out of favor with the baronet whose forces he attended. Mercenary work was a poor job by comparison, but it kept him fed. His skill with the bow made him valuable despite the fact that he wasn't nearly as physically imposing as either Daydan or Hespa. The three of them had formed a loose partnership some months ago and had been selling their services as a group ever since. Martin told me they'd done other jobs for the mayor, the most recent of which involved scouting some of the lands around Tinue. It took me about 10 minutes to realize Martin should be the leader of this expedition. He had more woodcraft than all the rest of us put together, and had even hunted men for bounty once or twice. When I mentioned this to him, he shook his head and smiled, telling me that being able to do something and wanting to do it were two very different things indeed. Last was me, their fearless leader. The mayor's letter of introduction had described me as a discerning young man of good education and diverse useful qualities. While this was perfectly true, it also made me sound like the most wretchedly useless court dandy in existence. Not helping matters was the fact that I was younger than any of them by years and wearing clothes more suited for a dinner party than the road. I carried my loot and the mayor's purse. I wore no sword, no armor, no knife. I dare say they didn't quite know what to make of me. The sun was about an hour from setting when we passed a tinker on the road. He wore the traditional brown robe, belted with a length of rope. He didn't have a cart, but led a single donkey so loaded with bundles of oddments that it looked like a mushroom. He made his slow way toward us, singing, "If you need no mending and nothing needs tending, a wise man will still see the right time for spending. Enjoy the sunshine, but though you might feel fine, if you don't stop now, you'll be filled with regret. It's better to simply pay and prepare for a rainy day than think of the tinker when you're dripping wet." I laughed and applauded. Proper traveling tinkers are a rare breed of people, and I am always glad to see one. My mother told me they were lucky, and my father had valued them for their news. The fact that I was in desperate need of a few items made this meeting 3 times welcome.
"Oh, tinker," Daydan said, smiling, "I need fire and a pint. How long before we hit an inn?"
The tinker pointed back the way he had come.
"Not 20 minutes walk." He eyed Daydan. "But you can't tell me there's nothing you need," he admonished. "Everyone needs something."
Daydan shook his head politely.
"I beg your pardon, tinker. My purse is too thin." "How about you?"
The tinker eyed me up and down.
"You've the look of a lad who's wanting something."
"I do need a few things," I admitted, seeing the others look longingly down the road. I motioned them on. "Go ahead," I told them. "I'll be a few minutes." As they headed off, the tinker rubbed his hands together, grinning.
"Well now, what is it you're looking for?"
"Some salt to begin with."
"And a box to put it in,"
he said as he began to rummage around in his donkey's packs. "I could use a knife, too, if you have one that's not too hard to come by."
"Especially if you're heading north," he said without missing a beat. "Dangerous road that way. Wouldn't do to be without a knife."
"Did you have any trouble?" I asked, hoping he might know something that could help us find the bandits.
"Oh, no," he said as he dug through his packs. "Things aren't so bad that anyone would dream of laying hands on a tinker. Still, it's a bad stretch of road."
He produced a long, narrow knife in a leather sheath and handed it to me.
"Ramsden steel."
I drew it out of its sheath and gave the blade a close look. It was Ramsden steel. "I don't need anything that fine," I said, handing it back. "I'll be putting it to everyday use, eating mostly."
"Ramsden's fine for everyday use," the tinker said, pushing it back into my hands. "You can use it to trim kindling, then shave with it if you like. Keeps an edge forever."
"I might have to put it to hard use," I clarified. "And Ramsden's brittle."
"There is that," the tinker admitted easily. As my father always used to say, the best knife you'll ever have until it breaks. But the same could be said of any knife, and truth be told, that's the only knife I have.
I sighed. I know when I'm being skinned. And a tinderbox? He held one out almost before I finished saying it.
I couldn't help but notice you got a little ink about the fingers.
He gestured at my hands.
I've got some paper here, good quality. Pen and ink, too. Nothing worse than having an idea for a song and not being able to write it down.
He held out a leather parcel of paper, pens, and ink. I shook my head, knowing that the mayor's purse would only stretch so far.
I think I'm done with songwriting for a while, Tinker.
He shrugged, still holding it out.
Letter writing, then? I know a fellow who had to open a vein once to write a note to his lady love. Dramatic, true. Symbolic, certainly. But also painful, unsanitary, and more than slightly macabre. Now he carries pen and ink with him wherever he goes.
I felt the color drain from my face as the tinker's words reminded me of something else I'd forgotten in my rush to leave Severin. Denna. All thought of her had been forced out of my mind by the mayor's talk of bandits, two bottles of strong wine, and a night with no sleep. I left without a word after our terrible fight. What would she think if I spoke so cruelly to her, then simply disappeared? I was already a full day's journey from Severin. I couldn't go back just to tell her I was leaving, could I? I considered it for a moment. No. Besides, Denna herself had disappeared for days without a word of warning. Surely she would understand if I did the same.
Stupid, stupid, stupid.
My thoughts spun in circles as I tried to decide among my several unpleasant options. The harsh hee-haw of the tinker's donkey startled a thought into me.
Are you headed to Severin, Tinker?
More through than two, he said. But yes.
I just remember a letter I needed to send. If I gave it to you, could you deliver it to a certain inn?
He nodded slowly.
I could, he said. Given that you'll be needing paper and ink.
He smiled, waving the package again. I grimaced.
I will, Tinker. But how much will the lot of this cost me?
He looked at the accumulated items.
Salt and box, 4 bits. Knife, 15 bits. Paper, pens, and ink, 18 bits. Tinderbox, 3 bits.
And the delivery, I said.
An urgent delivery, the tinker said with a bit of a smile. To a lady, unless I mistake the look on your face.
I nodded.
Right.
He rubbed his chin.
Ordinarily, I'd push for about 35, then have a nice leisurely dicker where you'll bargain me down to 30.
The price was reasonable, especially considering how hard it was to find good paper. Still, it was a full third of the money the mayor had given me. We would need that money for food, lodging, and other supplies. But before I could say anything, the tinker continued.
Now I can tell that's too much for your comfort, he said. And I hope you don't think me too forward in saying this, but that is a rather fine cloak you are wearing. I'm always willing to make a fellow a trade.
I pulled my lovely burgundy cloak around me self-consciously.
I suppose I'd be willing to give it up, I said, not having to fake the regret in my voice.
But that will leave me with no cloak at all. What will I do when it rains?
No trouble there, the tinker said.
He pulled a bundle of cloth out of a pack and held it up for me to see. It had been black once upon a time, but long use and many washings had faded it to a dark greenish color.
It's a little tatty, I said, reaching out to finger a fraying seam.
It's just broken in, that's all, he said easily, spreading it across my shoulders. Good fit. Good color for you. Brings out your eyes. Besides, you don't want to be looking too well off, what with those bandits on the road.
I sighed. What will you give me in trade? I asked, handing my beautiful cloak over to him. That cloak's not a month old, mind you, and it's never even seen a drop of rain. The tinker ran his hands over my beautiful cloak.
It's got all sorts of little pockets, he said admiringly. That's just lovely.
I fingered the thinning cloth of the tinker's cloak.
If you'll throw in needle and thread, I'll trade you my cloak for the lot of it, I said with sudden inspiration. Plus, I'll give you an iron penny, a copper penny, and a silver penny. I grinned. It was a pittance. But that's what tinkers in stories ask for when they trade some fabulous piece of magic to an unsuspecting widow's son when he's off to make his fortune in the world. The tinker threw his head back and laughed.
I was about to suggest that very thing, he said.
Then he tossed my cloak over his arm and shook my hand firmly. I fished around in my purse and handed over an iron drab, 2 vintage halfpennies, and, much to my pleasant surprise, an Aeturin hard penny. The last was lucky for me, as it was only worth a fraction of a vintage silver round. I emptied the 12 pockets of my burgundy cloak into my travel sack and collected my new possessions from the tinker. Then I wrote a quick letter to Denna, explaining that my patron had sent me away unexpectedly. I apologized for the rash things I'd said and told her I would meet with her as soon as I was back in Severin. I would have liked more time to compose it. I would have liked to give a more subtle apology, a more detailed explanation, but the tinker had finished packing away my beautiful cloak and was obviously eager to be on his way again. Not having any sealing wax to secure the letter, I used a trick I'd invented while writing notes on the mayor's behalf. I folded the piece of paper against itself, then tucked it together in such a way that it would be necessary to tear the paper in order to unfold it again. I handed it to the tinker. It goes to a pretty dark-haired woman by the name of Denna. She's staying at the Four Tapers in Severin Low.
That reminds me, he exclaimed as he tucked my letter into a pocket. Candles!
He reached into a saddlebag and pulled out a handful of fat tallow tapers.
Everyone needs candles!
Funny thing was, I could use some, though not for the reasons he thought.
I've also got some rubbing wax for your boots, he continued, rooting through his bundles. We get fierce rain this time of year.
I held up my hands, laughing. I'll give you a bit for 4 candles, but I can't afford any more. If this keeps up, I'll have to buy your donkey just to carry the lot with me.
Suit yourself, he said with an easy shrug. Pleasure doing business with you, young sir.
Chapter 76. Tinder. The sun was starting to set by the time we found a good place to camp on the second night. Daydan went foraging for firewood. Martin began cutting up carrots and potatoes and sent Hespa to fill the cookpot with water. I used Martin's small spade to dig a pit for our fire. Without being asked, Tempe picked up a branch and used his sword to shave thin strips of dry wood to use for tinder. Unsheathed, his sword still didn't seem terribly impressive, but given how easily it was peeling away paper-thin strips of wood, it must have been sharp as a shaving razor. I finished lining the pit with stones. Wordlessly, Tempe handed me a handful of tinder. I nodded. Would you like to use my knife? I asked, hoping to draw him into a bit of a conversation. I'd barely shared a 12 words with him in the last 2 days. Tempe's pale gray eyes looked at the knife on my belt, then back at his sword. He shook his head, fidgeting nervously. Isn't it bad for the edge? I asked. The mercenary shrugged, avoiding my eye. I began to lay the fire, and that was when I made my first mistake. As I've said, there was a chill in the air, and we were all of us tired. So rather than spend half an hour slowly nursing a spark into a decent campfire, I arranged twigs around Tempe's tinder, then stacked progressively bigger sticks around it, making a tightly packed cluster of wood. Daydan returned with another armload of firewood just as I was finishing.
Lovely, he groused,
quiet enough he could pretend he was just talking to himself, but loud enough so everyone could hear.
And you're in charge. Wonderful.
What's stuck in your teeth now? Martin asked, tiredly.
Boys making a little wooden fort, not a fire.
Daydan sighed dramatically, then assumed a tone he probably thought was fatherly, but came across as profoundly condescending.
Here, I'll help you out. A spark will never catch on that. Do you have flint and steel? I'll show you how to use them.
No one enjoys being talked down to, but I have a particular aversion to it. Daydan had been making it clear for 2 days that he thought I was an idiot. I gave a tired sigh, my oldest, most world-weary sigh. That was how I needed to play it. He thought of me as young and useless. I needed to drive home the point that I was nothing of the sort.
"Daydan," I asked, "what do you know about me?"
He gave me a blank look.
"You know one thing about me," I said calmly. "You know the mayor put me in charge."
I looked him in the eye. "Is the mayor an idiot?" Daydan made a dismissive gesture.
"Of course not. I was just saying."
I stood up and regretted it, as it just brought into sharp contrast how much taller he was.
"Would the mayor have put me in charge if I were an idiot?"
He gave an insincere smile, trying to pass off 2 days' worth of derogatory muttering as some sort of misunderstanding.
"Now, don't get all twisted up over..."
I held up my hand. "This isn't your fault. You just don't know anything about me. But let's not waste time on it tonight. We're all tired. For now, rest assured that I'm not some rich tit's son out for a lark." I pinched a thin piece of Tempe's tinder between my fingers and concentrated. I pulled more heat than I needed and felt my arm go chilly all the way to the shoulder. "And rest assured, I know how to start a fire." The shaved pieces of wood caught fire, flaring up hot and sudden, catching the rest of the tinder and making flames leap up almost instantly. I'd meant it to be a dramatic gesture so Daydan would stop thinking of me as some useless boy, but the time I spent at the university had made me jaded. Starting a fire like this was as simple as putting on your boots for a member of the Arcanum. Daydan, on the other hand, had never met an Arcanist, and probably hadn't ever been within 500 miles of the university. Everything he knew about magic was from campfire stories. So when the fire flared up, he went pale as a sheet and took several sudden steps back. He looked for all the world as if I'd suddenly called up a roaring sheet of fire like Taberlin the Great. Then I saw Martin and Hespa wearing the same expression, native vintage superstition written clearly on their faces. Their eyes went to the flickering fire, then back to me. I was one of those. I meddled with dark powers. I summoned demons. I ate the entire little cheese, including the rind. Looking at their stunned faces, I realized nothing I said would set them at ease. Not right now. So instead, I sighed and began to set up my sleeping roll for the night. While there wasn't much cheerful conversation around the fire that night, there wasn't any muttering from Daydan either. I'd like respect, but failing that, a little healthy fear can go a long way to making things run smoothly. 2 days with no further dramatics on my part helped everyone relax. Daydan was still all bluff and bravado, but he had quit calling me boy and was only complaining about half as much, so I considered it a victory. Flushed with this lukewarm success, I decided to make an active attempt to draw Tempe into a conversation. If I was going to be in charge of this little group, I needed to know more about him. Most importantly, I needed to know if he could speak more than 5 words in a row. So, I approached the Adem mercenary when we stopped for our midday meal. He was sitting slightly apart from the rest of us. He wasn't standoffish. It's just that the rest of us would sit and talk while we ate. Tempe, on the other hand, simply ate. But today, I made a point of sitting down next to him with my lunch, a chunk of hard sausage and some cold potatoes. "Hello, Tempe." He looked up and nodded. For a second, I caught a glimpse of his pale gray eyes. Then he looked away, shifting restlessly. He ran his hand through his hair, and for a second, he reminded me of Simon. They both had the same slender build and sandy hair. Simon wasn't this quiet, though. Sometimes I could barely get a word in edgewise with Sim. I tried to talk to Tempe before, of course. Ordinary small talk, the weather, sore feet after a long day's walk, the food, these had all come to nothing. At best, a word or two. More often, a nod or a shrug.
but most common was a blank look followed by fidgeting and a stubborn refusal to do so much as look me in the eye. So today, I had a conversational gambit. "I have heard stories about the Lethani," I said. "I would like to know more. Would you tell me about it?" Tempe's pale eyes touched mine briefly, his expression still blank. Then he looked away again. He tugged one of the red leather straps that held his shirt close to his body and fidgeted with his sleeve.
"No, I will not speak on Lethani. It is not for you. Do not ask."
He looked away from me again, down at the ground. I counted in my head. 16 words. That answered one of my questions, at least. Chapter 77. Pennyworth. Twilight was settling in as we rounded a curve in the road. I heard clapping and stomping mingled with music, shouting, and roars of laughter. After 10 hours of walking, the sound lifted my spirits to an almost cheerful level. Located at the last major crossroad south of the Eld, the Pennyworth Inn was enormous. Built of rough-hewn timber, it had 2 full stories and a scattering of gables that hinted at a smaller 3rd floor above that. Through the windows, I caught glimpses of men and women dancing while an unseen fiddler sawed out a mad and breathless tune. Daydan took a deep breath.
"Can you smell that? I tell ya, there's a woman in this place could cook a stone and make me beg for more. Sweet Peg. By these hands, I hope she's still around."
He made a curving gesture, showing me the double meaning of his words as he nudged Martin with an elbow. Hespa's eyes narrowed as she stared at the back of Daydan's head. Oblivious, Daydan continued.
"Tonight, I'll sleep with a belly full of lamb and brandy, although a little less sleeping might prove a little more entertaining, if my last trip here was any indication."
I saw the storm brewing on Hespa's face and spoke up quickly. "Whatever's in the pot and a bunk for each of us," I said firmly. "Anything else comes out of your own pocket." Daydan looked as if he couldn't quite believe his ears.
"Come off it! We've been sleeping rough for days. Besides, take your money. Don't be a stingy shim with it."
"We haven't done our job yet," I said calmly. "Not even a piece of it. I don't know how long we may be out here, but I know I'm not rich. If we run through the mayor's purse too quickly, we're going to have to hunt for what we eat." I looked around at everyone. "Unless someone else has enough coin to keep us fed and cares to share." Martin smiled ruefully at the suggestion. Hespa's eyes were for Daydan, who continued glowering in my direction. Tempe fidgeted, his expression unreadable as ever. Avoiding my eyes, he glanced at everyone in turn, his expression blank. His eyes moved not from face to face, but at Daydan's hands, then Daydan's feet, then Martin's feet, then Hespa's, then mine. He shifted his weight and moved a half step closer to Daydan. Hoping to dispel the tension, I softened my tone and said, "After everything is done, we'll split what's left of the purse. That way each of us will have a little extra in our pocket before we even get back to Severin. We can each spend our lots as we want to. Then." I could tell Daydan wasn't pleased and waited to see if he would press the point. Instead, it was Martin who spoke up.
"After a day of long walking," he said in a musing voice, as if talking to himself, "a drink would go down nice."
Daydan looked to his friend, then back to me expectantly.
"I think the purse can stand a round of drinks," I conceded with a smile. "I don't think the mayor is trying to make priests of us, do you?" This got a throaty laugh from Hespa, while Martin and Daydan cracked smiles. Tempe glanced at me with his pale eyes, fidgeted, and looked away. A few minutes of relaxed haggling got the 5 of us common bunks, a simple supper, and a round of drinks for a single silver bit. After that was done, I found a table in a quieter corner of the room and tucked my loot out of harm's way under my bench. Then I sat down,
bone-weary and wondering what I could do to get Daydan to stop acting like such a little swagger cock. Such was the distracted turning of my thoughts when my dinner thumped onto the table in front of me. I looked up to see a woman's face and well-advertised bosom framed by a